I'm Laura Murphy Oates, and this is The Full Story.
When the Tokyo Olympics officially kicked off today, it was under the most unusual circumstances in modern times. While 16 days of international competition...
It's safe to say that this Olympics is unlike any other. And with millions of people across the country tuning in from lockdown, interest is high. Friday's opening ceremony recorded the biggest national television audience of the year. And some are predicting a record year for Australia's medal tally as well. So what are the big stories from the Olympics so far? And what Australian athletes should we be barracking for? Today, Guardian Australia's guide to the Tokyo Olympics. It's Tuesday, the 27th of July. Cool. If you're recording, Emma, I'm happy to get whirling.
Okay. Yep.
Emma Kemp is Guardian Australia's deputy sport editor.
Okay, let's give it a go.
So, Emma, the confusingly named Tokyo 2020 Olympics is in full swing, but because of rights restrictions, we can't actually play much audio from the Olympics. But you were covering it around the clock, so I'm hoping that you can paint a picture of what it's like in Tokyo at the moment.
Well, there's no spectators there for a start, so...
Here we are inside the stadium. Normally this would be full with tens of thousands of people, but there's just a few school kids who I assume are in the ceremony.
It's kind of eerie. It's a little bit echoey if you're watching on TV. For journalists there, it lacks that buzz, and it's almost intangible, but that's just completely missing, you know? So, for instance, on Sunday, the women's 4x100-metre freestyle relay team, they broke their own world record and, you know, won a third consecutive gold at an Olympic Games. And it was just this incredible moment. And yet on the ground, it was like the air was kind of sucked out of the stadium in a sense.
Right, so all this is trying to prevent a COVID outbreak at the Olympics, which is a bizarre sentence to say out loud. How live an issue is that? And have we come close to it already?
I think it's been a live issue for months. I mean, we had a standing bet in the office at one point about whether the games were going ahead. And as it got closer to the time, you know, more people were saying, yep, it's going to happen. It's inevitable. And I was the only one who was saying it wasn't going to happen. And of course I was proved wrong, but I just couldn't get over the fact that you would take a number of people from a whole lot of different countries in the world, plonk them into one place and then send them back home. There were predictions that we were going to have an Olympic variant of COVID-19, which, look, I guess could still happen.
So wait, the new Delta would be the Olympic COVID. That was the fear.
Yeah. And I mean, look, that would be the International Olympic Committee's worst nightmare, I think, if this Games were to go down as sort of producing a new variant in the outbreak. But yeah, look, like to your question, it has been a live issue. There have been athletes who have tested positive. It's upwards of 75 people with Olympic credentials. So that's not just athletes. That's all those other people that I mentioned as well who have tested positive for coronavirus. And there's been about half a dozen athletes.
Right. Regardless of all of these fears around COVID, it has gone ahead. There hasn't been a mass outbreak as yet. You were live blogging the opening ceremony. Can you tell me about that?
I actually really like the performances. I found them really beautiful. And, you know, Naomi Osaka lighting the cauldron was a really special moment. Australia came out, of course, and the flag bearers were Patty Mills, who was Australia's first Indigenous flag bearer, and Kate Campbell, who was our first female flag bearer, who was a swimmer. But I guess it was also really strange because there were these mass protests going on outside the stadium.
A lot of people out there in Tokyo, Japan say the Olympics are not welcome there due to the coronavirus pandemic and cases.
It's unethical to proceed with such a big event.
No one's allowed into the stadium tonight, so instead they seem to be lining the streets outside.
And because there were no spectators inside, everybody could hear them.
You could hear those people chanting right outside, calling for those games to essentially not be held at all.
So, you know, you had journalists tweeting that they could hear hundreds of protesters outside. And for me, that kind of environment was really epitomised when the IOC president, Thomas Bach, was giving his speech. You know, they do all those official speeches to open the games, and he was saying all the things that you know, he and his predecessors say at every Olympic Games about them uniting the world and being a beacon of hope, you know, amid adversity. Mm. When in reality, it was simply a case of honouring a contract and ensuring the IOC isn't out of pocket. So that moment was really kind of ironic for me.
You see the police there talking to the crowds, trying to do crowd control. This big sign right there coming through says, Olympics kill the poor. They do have signs in both English and in Japanese as they are taking to the streets out there.
I mean, the sound of mass cheering being replaced with mass protest surely goes down as a moment in Olympic history, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, Tokyo is under a state of emergency at the moment. Infection tolls are surging, deaths are surging. The sentiment among a large proportion of the population is that these games shouldn't be happening at all, you know, due to health and safety, but also due to the spiraling financial costs to the country, to the economy.
Mm. You're going to be watching all throughout. I know you've got an incredible maybe 20-day streak of coverage planned for the Olympics.
It's going to be fun.
There are some incredible Australian athletes who are, you know, making a debut or who are tipped to get a gold medal. I'm wondering if you can talk through what you're most looking forward to and what's already been some exciting moments for the Olympics.
Well, maybe I'll start briefly with the swimming because our team, we just have this crack team who have already started winning medals and who are going to continue to win medals. And I know every time an Olympics rolls around, we say we have a crack swimming team, but it hasn't really been the case the last couple of Olympic Games. Of course, we had in 2012, we had that sort of report that came out that there was a toxic environment. In 2016, we did have some success, but we also disappointed in comparison to the US, who've always been our great rivals, and to Great Britain, who've been coming along quite a lot since the 2012 Games. But now we have this new generation coming through and the success is, it's already starting to really show. On Monday morning, we just had this incredible moment and was really one of the highlights of the Games for Australia when Ariane Titmus beat Katie Ledecky in the women's 400-metre freestyle. This rivalry has been going on for a long time. Ledecky is one of the all-time great swimmers. And, I mean, that's going to be, when we look back on these games, that's going to be one of the real absolute highlights for Australia. And it also has put the US really on notice about what this Australian team means. Australia also won some other medals on Monday morning. Emma McKeon took out bronze in the 100-metre butterfly, and the men's 4x100-metre relay won bronze as well. So Australia's overall Tokyo tally now stands at 2 golds, 1 silver, and 3 bronze, and they've all been won by swimmers. That's as of, I should qualify, on Monday afternoon, so there'll be some more finals on Tuesday morning. But yeah, swimming aside, we're probably on track to do quite well in a number of other sports.
Where else other than swimming do you think that we've got a good chance?
I think we're looking relatively good in the basketball. I mean, it was on Sunday night, the Boomers beat Nigeria in their opening match, and it wasn't a polished performance. They had 22 turnovers, but Patty Mills was a standout, and, you know, Dante Exum and Joe Ingles played really well. And if anything, it was a solid start against a Nigeria team that actually has quite a few NBA players in it. And judging by the fact that we beat the US only about 2 weeks ago, actually, in a scrimmage, which is a practice match, but it was only the second time we've ever beat the USA in our history.
And they're the team to beat, I imagine.
They are, correct. They're very much the team to beat.
Next, the athletes using their Olympic platform to speak out about racism and sexism. a team that's been in the headlines a lot are the Matildas. I'm wondering if you can give us an overview of what's happened in football so far and what our chances are there.
So the Matildas are a funny one for me because there's been just this incredible expectation on them that they're going to win a medal, that they're potentially going to win a gold medal. And actually, they haven't really been up there for quite some time. You know, they were ranked fourth in the world in 2018, but since then they've slipped to ninth. They had a disappointing 2019 World Cup campaign. And before the Olympics, under new coach Tony Gustafsson, who is Swedish, but he was actually an assistant coach to the USA until very recently, and they're, you know, the top-ranked team in the world. They, under him, they suffered some really heavy friendly defeats to Germany included and to the Netherlands, and they came into this tournament not in very good form at all, really. Of course, Sam Kerr is being marked out of the game in essentially every game because she's so good. She's such a prolific scorer. Everyone is targeting her. They had a really good start. I've got to say that when they played New Zealand, that's the best I've seen them play this year. And finally, their front third was looking like they could do something. And then they played Sweden on Saturday night and lost 4-2. So there's a lot of pressure on them now to beat the USA, which is a pretty tall task on Tuesday night. That match starts at 6 p.m. I'm going to be blogging it, which should be really fun, depending on how many goals are scored and how quick I need to type.
Outside of their winning chances, the Matildas and football more generally have been making headlines for their support for Black Lives Matter, taking the knee before each game. Can you tell me a bit about that? Which teams have thrown their weight behind this and why?
Yeah, look, a number of teams have taken the knee and we saw it. It started in the football with the women's sides, the US, Sweden, Chile, Britain, New Zealand did so in their opening match against the Matildas. Mm. It's become such a widely practiced anti-racism gesture that it's not surprising at all. The reason that it is a little bit surprising in the Olympics context is that Olympians traditionally have not been allowed to express any kind of protest or political gesture at an Olympic Games.
Why so?
Because, I mean, it's called Rule 50 in the Olympic Charter, and the wording is that it's perceived as being propaganda.
Interesting.
Which sounds extraordinarily archaic. And it is really, and there was a lot of pressure on the IOC this year to actually scrap that rule altogether. They didn't, but they did tweak it to allow players and athletes to make political gestures, but only at specific times, like for instance, before a match on the field of play, but not on a medal podium, for instance. So that meant that players and athletes were allowed to take a knee before matches. I don't know if you saw that the Matildas, instead of doing that, they unfurled an Aboriginal flag before their opening match, which was a really lovely gesture.
And I did see that moment and, you know, I was not surprised, especially seeing that we have strong Indigenous representation on the team, that this was the way that they decided to show their support for this moment.
Yeah, and Sam Kerr actually said after the match that they did consult the Indigenous players on their team in Kaya Simon and in goalkeeper Lydia Williams and really spoke to them about how they would best like to express that representation and that support, and that's in the end what they decided as a team, and it was a really nice moment.
Despite this relaxing of this rule around political statements, I did see some coverage last week that the Olympic Committee was not allowing the social media teams to post about taking the knee. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, so it was last week. It was actually a Guardian exclusive that the IOC in Tokyo 2020 organizers banned their social media teams. The order came from on high that said that they're not allowed to post any pictures of athletes taking the knee. Mm. The interesting thing was that about 24 hours later, they backflipped on that decision. And they did it in this way that was sort of a little bit quiet, a little bit furtive. They didn't release a statement. They just, the Olympics official account just tweeted a picture of Team GB player Lucy Bronze taking a knee and said nothing more about it, which was basically a roundabout way of saying we're allowed to, I suppose.
What about the men's football? We've talked a lot about the Matildas.
Yeah. So, look, the men's football have been the surprise of the tournament, really.
Mm.
They weren't supposed to even make the Olympic Games. They haven't made the Olympic Games since 2008. And even back then, they went out in the group stage. And there's been a lot of talk around the development pathways in men's football in Australia, that they haven't been very good, that we've got a long way to go. And then all of a sudden they qualified. No one really even noticed that they'd qualified. And just to clarify that in the Olympics, the men's football is actually under 23. So we hadn't sent our senior team, which is the Socceroos. We send our under 23s team, which is the Olleroos. So nobody even realized they'd qualified.
Mm.
And then on last Thursday night, they came out and beat Argentina, which were a highly fancied team in the group of death. And they were playing really good football. You know, there were a lot of fans who turned on to watch it and was like, hey, look at us playing football against a good team.
So do you feel like our medal chances are looking a little bit better there on the men's side?
I'm not going to take it quite that far. I don't want to get ahead of myself. And also, it's got to be said that on Sunday night, the Olleroos played Spain and it was a very different match to what the match was against Argentina. Mm. Spain very much controlled the entire 90 minutes. And credit to Australia, their defensive shape was sound. And somehow they held Spain out until the 81st minute when they eventually scored. But, you know, this was a team which has six players from its Euro 2020 senior squad in it. So, I mean, they were always fancied to win. But having said that, Australia still sits second in their group and they basically just need a draw against Egypt on Wednesday night to go through. And that still is punching above their weight in terms of expectation.
So one that I was personally looking forward to watching was tennis, especially after Ash Barty's win at Wimbledon. But some not so great news about that over the weekend.
Not so great, no. So Ash Barty, she arrived in Tokyo hoping to leave as Australia's first singles gold medalist. And then she went and lost to somebody ranked 48th in the world in Spaniard Sara Cerebus Tormo, who beat her in straight sets 6-4, 6-3. I've watched most of Ash Barty's matches this year and it was honestly the worst I've seen her play. She had 55 unforced errors. And even she, you know, eventually she did do some media. She described it as loose and erratic, which is pretty accurate, really. And I think the shock of it was that she'd just won Wimbledon and she'd just done it in such emphatic fashion that it was basically seemed like a foregone conclusion that she was going to at least make the final in the singles match. So it was really inexplicable to watch. There's been a lot of talk about the heat and humidity in Tokyo and that it's really brutal for the players. Novak Djokovic certainly said that the other day. Mm. And she could have used that as an excuse if she wanted to, but, you know, in true Ash Barty form, she said she didn't. She said, you know, it's like the Australian summer. I really like playing in the Australian summer, et cetera, et cetera. So, of course, you know, she was very measured in defeat.
Mm. I feel like we've covered a lot of the very iconic Australian sports in the chat so far. Speed round, who should we be watching? Who are you most excited for out of the people that we haven't got to touch on?
So I really love athletics. I'm kind of obsessed with athletics. I've covered it at a couple of Olympics. So I've been there for some pretty big moments internationally, but I've also been there when the Australian team has done pretty well, but not crazy well. And there is actually a generation of athletes coming through on the track and field who are really exciting to me and are medal hopes. I guess our best medal hopes in the athletics is high jumper Nicola McDermott. She is probably a very good chance. She's third in the world this year in terms of the leaps that she's been pulling off. And there's a middle distance runner called Stuart McSwain, who will probably at least make the final. He's in the men's 1500, 5,000 metres and 10,000 metres. But the one I'm really excited for is a pole vaulter named Nina Kennedy. Mm. And it's partly because I really love the pole vault and I just find it really scary that they can actually can actually not chicken out of something like that. But Nita Kennedy is really in very good form, which is kind of seems like a bit of an anomaly because a lot of pole vaulters, I'm not really sure why this phenomenon occurs, but particularly a lot of female pole vaulters don't really seem to hit their peak until they're sort of approaching 30.
Mm.
But she's in her early 20s and she broke the Australian record in March with a jump of 4.82 metres. That jump would have actually earned her a bronze medal at the 2016 Olympics. And fun trivia fact, she did that with an old pole of Alana Boyd's, who actually came fourth in the Rio Olympics and was the Australian record that she actually broke. So she broke her Australian record using one of her old poles.
She had a lucky pole, it
yeah,
sounds like.
Yeah, she had a rival's lucky pole. So obviously another massive sport for Australia is surfing, which makes its Olympic debut in Tokyo, or to be accurate, just a little bit outside of Tokyo at a beach. So that started on Sunday and every Australian went through to the knockout stages in Owen Wright, Sally Fitzgibbons and Steph Gilmore, and Julian Wilson was the only one to lose his opening heat, which forced him into a knockout heat. The USA and Brazil, which are huge surfing nations, were the other countries to progress straight through. But in news on Monday, unfortunately, Steph Gilmore, who was one of the big hopes, you know, she's won 7 world championships, she lost and she was out. So she's gone. We've got 3 still in there.
One other thing that I wanted to touch on, Emma, was about the treatment of women in particular during these games, because there has been some high-profile coverage of some controversies. What have we seen?
Yeah, and look, I guess this is supposed to be sort of the women's games because we're at a moment in time now where we're really recognising how far women's sport has come and really respecting women as athletes. And, you know, that was reflected in the fact that Australia is sent a record number of female athletes to Tokyo. But, you know, of course, with more attention comes more controversy, I guess.
Have you heard this story? It sounds like it is probably out of place in the modern era, but members of the Norwegian volleyball team have been fined €1,500 for refusing to play in the Bikini Bottoms.
Days before the games opened, we all heard about Norway's beach volleyball team.
That's in and of itself a bit mad. But what was said to them in being fined was that they need to wear the right uniform, both for reasons of performance, but for reasons of maintaining the attractiveness of the sport. And I have to say,
that was followed by Britain's long jumper, Olivia Breen.
This official came up to me and was like, "Can I talk to you?" And I was like, "Yeah, sure. Like, what's up?" You know,
who was then told off for wearing briefs that were too short.
And I didn't know what to say. I just looked speechless and I just said to her, "Are you joking?"
Mm. So one's not long enough, the other one's too short.
Yeah. No one can get it right. The women can never get it right. And, you know, vis-a-vis Monday morning when Germany's female gymnasts wore long leotards. So tradition has it that female gymnasts wear bikini-cut leotards. However, the German team instead wore these unitards that stretched right down to their ankles, and they did that to push back against what Germany's Sport Federation has called sexualization in gymnastics. So it just seems that women athletes are learning what's okay and what's not okay and getting a bit pissed off, to be frank, that they are receiving so much attention on what they're wearing and what they look like when their male counterparts really aren't. It's not really an issue.
I mean, it just seems bizarre to me that an athlete can train all their life for this event and then the news headline from that event could be what they're wearing.
Yeah, and it unfortunately it reflects a lot of society, you know. You have female politicians, they attract more attention on what they're wearing than what their male politicians do. Same goes for news presenters. You know, you could apply it to pretty much any industry, and that's been the case. And unfortunately for these athletes, they just happen to be competing in front of the world.
So, Emma, we got 29 medals in Rio, 8 of them gold. I know it's still really, really early in the Olympics, but I'm wondering if we can you know, have a little bet. How many medals do you think that we'll get?
I think we're going to get 36. That's a stab. Partly, I have to tell the truth that there is a big stats company that sends around these virtual medal tables.
Cheating.
Yeah. So they've actually predicted 40 medals all up with 16 golds.
Wow. Do you know what they base that on?
Yeah, it's pretty amazing what they do actually. So they're a Dutch sports statistics company, and they collate data from results, world championships results, all that sort of thing. And they bring it together and they update it. They send one out about a year before the games, marking a year to go. Then they send one out, you know, I think it's 3 months before the games. And this most recent one came out just last week.
If we got, you know, high 30s in the medals, is that a high amount for Australia? That sounds fairly impressive.
Yeah, it is, especially in comparison to the last couple of games at least. It would keep us in the top 10 on the medal table, which is significantly better than what we've done in the past.
That was Emma Kemp, Guardian Australia's deputy sport editor. To follow along the Guardian's live coverage of the Tokyo Olympics, head to theguardian.com to find our live blog. Emma and the team have also put together some great guides on Australian athletes and best events to watch. We've linked those on the full story page as well. This episode was produced by Ellen Leibeater, Miles Herbert, Jane Lee, Karishma Luthria, and Joe Koning, who also did the sound design. The executive producers of Full Story are Miles Martignoni, Gabrielle Jackson, and myself, Laura Murphy-Oates. If you liked this episode, don't forget to leave a rating or a review. Okay, catch you next time.